Hello, and welcome back to Private Markets Made Human, the podcast from Hamilton Lane that brings information and perspective from our greatest asset, our people. My name is Jackie Rantanen. I've been with the firm for 25 years, and while I've held a few different titles here, my current role is Head of Investor Solutions within our Evergreen Portfolio Management team. I'm thrilled to be guest hosting today's show. Many of our listeners have watched or read our annual market overview. It's a comprehensive and, we believe, unique perspective on the markets. It showcases our industry insights, research capabilities, and expansive proprietary database to identify what lies ahead for alternative assets, and in particular, for the private markets. Today, we're joined by Executive Co-Chairman, former CEO, and the brains behind the Hamilton Lane Market Overview, Mario Giannini. We'll dive into several of the most compelling topics from this year's report, and who knows, maybe Mario will tell us about his favorite overview from years past. Mario, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with some context. How long has Hamilton Lane been producing a market overview, and how long have you been writing the narrative?
Well, the actual market overview is quite a bit older than everyone thinks. I think it's probably 20-some years old. It originally started, and I think someone got the original first one, something like 12 pages. And it was done as part of one of our fund's annual meetings, and we would do kind of a brief market overview. Obviously, 12 pages, really brief. And then it just kept growing in terms of what we would add to it. And the whole market overview, as you think of it now, has probably been 7 or 8 years where we had a full narrative and we had a full presentation. I think it's 7 or 8 years.
And there's quite a few people around the firm involved. Can you give a sense of like the team involvement? Who really works with you on this?
Oh, it is, I don't know, it's got to be 25 people that are involved in actually producing the market overview, ranging from people who are doing the creative work around it, which, as you know, is a key part of it, to people that are doing the research behind some of the pieces within the market overview, people that are doing pieces within the pieces. So if we need the fund investment team working on something, it is a huge effort. And the other part, which I think is worth noting, the market overview used to be presented on a stage with 2 or 3 people doing the presentation. With the pandemic, we decided to do it as a video, which proved to be the greatest thing, I think, that happened to the market overview, because not only are there 25 or 30 people working behind the scenes, if you will, there's 30 Hamilton Laners presenting and presenting really well. So when you think about that video, which, you know, obviously we're doing now past the pandemic, because it's just proven to be so effective, it engages a much broader audience at Hamilton Lane, and it engages a much broader audience around the world that looks at it and says, I know that person, or they connect faces. It's just worked out as a really key part of the market overview.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But and when I say we, I mean you, like to get creative with each year's theme. What's been your favorite theme so far?
I don't know if it's my favorite theme in terms of the theme, but King Midas, because I felt very proud of the fact that we got the market top, if you will, right. Because if you recall, the theme then was, it was so easy to make money, and King Midas, obviously with the legend, it turns out not to have been so great. And so I feel like we did a good job on that one, and it was a fun theme to work with. You could really weave it into, you know, the greed around private markets and some of the practitioners and what's going on. So that one was fun, but I would say because, and I will call out one of our Hamilton Laners, Mo Smith in our creative team, really is the genius behind all of the art and how it's presented, how it looks. And I feel like every time I look at one of them and I look at what she has done to make the theme capture the imagination, it's hard to find a particular one I love more than another.
That's fair. But why did you choose Hamlet this year?
Well, Hamlet originally started, it went, interestingly, in a different direction. It originally started as I wanted something around the indecision in the market, that it felt like people couldn't decide what to do and so did nothing. They sort of didn't want to commit, they didn't want to invest, things were uncertain. And then it became, oddly enough, I watched Kenneth Branagh's version of Hamlet, where it is indecision, but it's also appearance versus reality. And I thought, that really works, because that is part of the private market's dilemma, that everyone has this view of what's really going on, the appearance, but we have the data that shows a reality that is sometimes different from what the appearance is. And then with the indecision, I thought it was an interesting theme to do. And I think, again, going back to Mo and the creative team, there's a visual element to it that I think we all thought would be interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that. But let's dig in a little bit and talk about this year's overview. So we'll kick things off with an always popular topic, performance. So what was the punchline this year in comparing public markets to private markets performance?
It's the same punchline that it's been for 20 years, 25 years, however long we've been measuring this stuff. Private markets, whether it's private equity, whether it's private credit, infrastructure outperforms the public indices. And this year, we really harped around the notion of why do people simply not believe it, accept it, and we keep going into that. But that's the punchline. And you can cut it any which way you want to cut it. You can cut it by top quartile. You can cut it by median. You can cut it by average. It just outperforms. And it's one of the great, I think, mysteries of why people simply refuse to accept that fact. And so we keep presenting the data, and at some point people will stop arguing with the data, but I don't know that we'll be alive for that.
I hope so. We talk a lot about the importance of portfolio construction, and in today's market, it's as important as ever. How should investors be thinking about portfolio construction in this environment and its impact on performance?
Yeah, I mean, portfolio construction in private markets is an interesting thing. We've often, and I've heard you say this too, Jackie, in the public markets, people say that, 95% of performance is attributable to asset allocation. And I assume that's true. We're not public markets people. In the private markets, if you listen to both GPs and LPs, that answer is zero. Like, asset allocation doesn't matter. You pick the greatest deal that comes down the pike. You pick the greatest partnership. And our view is that's simply not true. I don't know that it's 95%, but it's got to be 50%. And so if you think about today's market, and I hear it, you hear it when you go out and talk to people, many of them lament, oh, I wish I hadn't done so much venture or growth in 2020 and 2021. That's a portfolio construction question. That is not an asset a portfolio selection or picking a partnership or a transaction. That's a construction question. How much venture or growth do you want? And I would argue that many people found themselves with more than they thought they would have because they were picking deal by deal as it came in the door. And so our argument would be you need to pay attention to how you construct a portfolio. And how you construct it matters on your governance, matters on your objectives, matters on your time frame, matters on your risk profile. So I would say today, nothing is more important than portfolio construction. So I ask you today, everyone says venture is beaten down. Do you want to have 25% in venture? And there's no right answer, right? But you need to make that a top down, not a bottom up. And too much of our asset class is spent, and this is both true for LPs and GPs, too much is spent bottom up.
It'd be interesting to see if the data actually helps to sway people.
Yeah, I don't know if it will. I don't know if it will, because it's so much more fun to look at the next deal than it is to spend a day trying to figure out whether you should do more buyout or growth or Europe or Asia. I mean, it's more fun to look at the next deal. And I think people underestimate how much fun or the factor of fun has to do with what you're putting into your portfolios.
And yet, the skeptics are not only talking about performance, as you say, but also about valuations. It just seems to continue to be a topic. They can't be accurate. It was a big part of our 2023 market overview, and it continues to be a hot topic today. Why do you think it is? Why don't people seem to be able to get their heads around the valuation piece?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One is there's always an anecdote or two that suggests something is overvalued. I mean, there just always is. And It tends to be an anecdote in an area like venture or growth that is a more well-known company that everyone kind of has heard of. And so that drives the view of, oh, they're all overvalued or unfairly valued. I think it also gets to this question of skepticism about performance. This performance can't be real. Well, the numbers show it's real, so you attack the numbers. I mean, you just keep kind of dissembling everything until you get to the last thing you can talk about. So I will attack the return numbers by saying, you know, forget it, the valuations aren't real. But you sort of have to go back and say, if the valuations are systemically wrong in private, let's use private equity, then you would have seen it somehow over the last 20 years. Like, there would have been a period where the valuations just crater because they weren't accurate in the prior period or whenever you're talking about. We just have not seen that. We just have not seen that. And we certainly didn't see it in this cycle. Remember, as you said, in 23, we spent the whole year defending valuations. And then the public markets went up and everyone went, oh, well, I guess they weren't right or wrong, but let's not talk about it anymore. And I don't know. I see no evidence for any systemic problem in valuations around certainly buyout. Obviously, in venture, you do valuations based on the last round of financing. So, you know, there is some room in terms of movement depending on when the financing happens. But let's get real. Most portfolios are predominantly buyout. So that's where your valuations are really coming into focus.
But I thought that analysis that we did on the buyout valuations in particular over the past 2 years, where the market was pretty challenging, was pretty interesting in terms of the data and the conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of things. The one that we've done over and over is, what price are the assets being sold 1, 2, or 3 quarters after the valuation? And consistently over the last, I think, 20 years, there is a significant increase in the price at which an asset is sold versus the carrying value. So that suggests that there's not this sort of problem with too high a valuation. But then when you look at part of the reason why valuations held up so well in private portfolios, one was everyone compares it to the S&P or the Russell. The nature of the companies in private equity are not the same as in the S&P or the Russell. Private equity did not have those huge technology companies whose multiple really varied significantly up and down. So we didn't have that kind of volatility in it. We don't have any real estate operating companies. So areas that were struggling in the economy didn't struggle in private equity portfolios. So the earnings were actually better in private equity portfolios than they were in the public markets. And so you look at that and say, okay, there's a reason why these valuations didn't reflect what was happening in the public markets on a you know, one-for-one percentage basis.
So are you saying that private asset valuations and listed asset valuations shouldn't move in lockstep?
They move in some lockstep, but they don't move in dollar-for-dollar terms or percentage-for-percentage terms. They will vary, again, depending on the composition of the private portfolios and the performance of those private portfolios. If I tell you that in the private markets, the earnings were double what they were in the public markets, you would not expect, you have to look at that and go, well, they can't be moving down the way they would be in the public markets because the earnings are better. So I think there is a correlation. I think the last thing we saw is it's 0.4, 0.6, I can't remember the exact number, but it will move directionally, but it won't move. Like, if one is up or down 20%, doesn't mean the other will be up or down 20%.
I think important, we talk about the need to evaluate where we are right now, like this particular macroeconomic moment, against a longer term perspective. How do you think that helps frame the conversation around valuations? And do you think that puts it into perspective, or should it a little bit?
In terms of saying if the macro is good or bad?
In terms of, you know, I think that people are used to a macro environment, you know, kind of disconnected from the private markets almost, whereas yeah. I think right here, right now, we're in a moment with so many factors. If you step back, maybe that's more important in terms of valuations.
Well, I mean, it certainly is in the sense of, remember, I think private valuations are done both on multiple comparison, but also discounted cash flow. And so you're not really looking at what's happened in the last day, and therefore I've got to change all my valuations. And so that's certainly a factor. And I think it's fair to say, in any context, part of why you're investing in private markets is for that longer term time frame. It is illiquid, and it's illiquid for a reason. And that reason is, it bluntly keeps you from making the mistake you always make, which is, oh, I'm scared, I'm getting out. Well, when you're scared is usually the time to get in. And so I do think that that time frame and the ability to look at the current environment, whenever you're looking at it, and say, I've got a longer term perspective is very important.
Yeah. So with all that, what's your outlook for valuations in 2024?
Well, I think it does then have a little bit to do with the macroeconomic environment, in the sense that if the U.S. economy in particular, but global economies, go into a coordinated downturn, then I would expect valuations will struggle in the private markets, not because public markets are going up or down, but because earnings will struggle. And at the end of the day, that is the driver for returns in the private markets. It's what are the companies earning? But absent that expectation, which I don't think we expect any kind of significant downturn, then I would say valuations are probably going to be reasonably good in the private markets over the next year. I don't see a situation where valuations are going to precipitously decline, and I certainly don't see a situation where valuations are going to decline because they're making up for any decline they should have had last year for having been overvalued, which is what you do hear quite a bit still.
I agree with that. All right, let's shift topics a little bit and talk about fundraising. Now, it's no secret that it's been a challenging fundraising environment. From a dollar perspective, fundraising is down for the second year in a row and down about 35% from peak levels. It also seems that larger funds are grabbing a larger share of LP capital. Are we all doomed here, or is there any silver lining in the data around fundraising?
Well, some are doomed more than others, I think is probably what we can say. Look, you know this. We have been talking about the fundraising environment as being challenged for a couple of years, and it really had nothing to do with the market downturn or the denominator effect that everyone was talking about. That made it worse, and made people far more conscious of not investing. But the issue in the private markets, we believe, that has happened is there is simply too much demand from general partners for capital and not enough capital from limited partners. The industry has grown too much for the capital that's available. And what's interesting is it hasn't grown the way it did in the past. In the past, what would happen is I would raise a flagship fund of $10 billion and I'd want $20 billion and there'd either be enough capital or there wouldn't. What's happened this time is that basically everybody has decided I need a family of funds, and it's sort of like a bad mushroom field. Everybody has a million funds. I've got my big buyout fund, my not so big buyout fund, my buyout fund that doesn't fit the other two, and my not buyout fund that I'm calling whatever else I can think of. Just a proliferation of products. There is not enough capital out there to provide the money needed to fund this industry as it's grown. And this industry isn't like, we've often talked about this, this industry is sort of a industry of vampires. You cannot kill general partners. You cannot kill funds. There's no, whether they use a stake, a silver stake, or whatever they use to get rid of a vampire. And so the industry finds itself in a place where a fund family doesn't go away, but it doesn't thrive. It doesn't do as well. And I think that's what we're in this period of time. And I think it's going to be 3 or 4 years. It's kind of like the Hunger Games. Some people will do better than others, and some are really going to struggle to adapt to the environment and figure out what they do. I simply don't believe, even if the market went up 50% from here, I don't think this problem with fundraising is going to go away.
Wait,
is that a silver lining, or is that?
I
think what you point out is correct. The big will get bigger.
Right.
And that is true. I mean, that has been true in almost every industry around the world, in every field, whether it's asset management or anything else. And I suspect that will continue to be true because They have the brand. They have the resources they can throw into raising capital. They have more, I'll call it cushion, in terms of if this product doesn't do well, I'll move to another product that are, that's already established. So I do think there will be a movement. And in a world where limited partners have to make choices, they will tend to gravitate towards what they know and what they have funded for the longest period of time, which tends to be the bigger managers. So this will be a very, very difficult environment for new managers, for smaller managers. You better have something that is unique and something that differentiates you from other funds in someone's portfolio.
What about the private wealth side of the market? You know, we survey a global set of private wealth managers as a part of our market overview this year. And we asked them about their plans to allocate to the private markets in 2024 and whether it was a change from what they had done the prior year. And almost 75% said they were going to increase their allocation from the previous year. So that's potentially a lot of capital. What does it mean for the asset class?
Well, here, I think we have a different take on what it means. What it certainly means, I think we all agree, is that there's more money that's going to come into the, particularly private equity, private credit, to some extent infra. There's just more capital as this channel understands how to use private equity, private markets, and products are created, structures are created that, that benefit it. That's a good thing in the sense of there's more capital. The two things that will be an issue or will be, we all have to look at, number one, I think it will drive the big to be bigger. Mm. There's this view that it is like the institutional channel where you just kind of walk in and have your product. It couldn't be any more different. The distribution channels are different. The amount of education and time needed to be spent both with the distribution channel and with the end client, very different. And so to us, as we look at it, what it means is you've got to have a pretty robust infrastructure to service that that channel well. That sort of favors the bigger players, which is part one. Part two is who it really will begin to impact, and you're beginning to hear some conversation around it, are the institutional investors. And so they look at it and say, wait a minute, is that channel going to take allocation away from some of my favorite managers? I think the answer today is no. But is that the answer tomorrow? I don't know the answer to that. And then the last thing I will say is, what none of us know yet is how will this wealth channel react to a prolonged bear market, a prolonged downturn? Right. We haven't had that. I suspect it will be. I've said to people, it took the institutional channel really about 20 years to get comfortable, to understand the nuances of how to invest in private markets and its behavior up and down. It's crazy to think that the private wealth channel will figure that out in 12 months. It's going to take some period of time, and we will all learn in the process. So I think it's going to be a phenomenally large and interesting channel, but it is very, very young.
Right. It's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch on all the fronts that you say. All right, Mario, we discussed how inactive really GPs were in 2023. As a percentage of unfunded capital, 2023 private market contributions came in at levels not seen since the GFC. And while it wouldn't have been surprising to see credit higher, it really was across the board. What are the implications?
Well, I think there are a couple. The most immediate implications is to the question of fundraising, as you go back to limited partners and say, give me more money or I need more capital, they go, what the hell for? I mean, you're not spending it today. Why should I give you any more? It also, you know, one of the things that we all do in raising capital is create a sense of urgency. You're going to miss this deal. You're going to miss this opportunity. You're not missing a lot with deal activity down. It also, clearly, when you think about deal activity from the buyer side, it also creates slow deal activity on the sell side, which means portfolios are being held longer, which has an impact on IRR. And I think it really speaks to how much confidence do you have in the environment when deal activity is low. And I think what you're seeing and what you're hearing is people are simply uncertain how to price assets. that's, to me, the driver of why deal activity is slow. If I'm a seller, I don't want to take any discount on what I believe this asset's worth because sales are good, revenue, earnings, everything's good. And if I'm a buyer, I'm saying, well, wait a minute, am I buying at peak earnings if the market turns down or if the economy turns down? So to me, one of the big themes of 24 is going to be who blinks first, buyer or seller. And history suggests it will be the buyers, whether driven by, oh my gosh, I got to start doing deals, otherwise I'm not going to be credible in the market anymore. But that to me is the big question. Right now there's that disconnect between buyers and sellers in a fairly meaningful way. And somebody is going to have to bridge that gap, whether it's meeting halfway. I don't know what the answer to that, but that is what I think we all ought to be watching pretty carefully. Who is meeting the bid-ask spread? Is it the buyer, the seller, or are they just deciding to cut the difference?
Well, speaking of that, I mean, we know investors are fixated on purchase price multiples. And right now, multiples in the private markets are at record levels in Europe and Asia, and pretty close to that in the U.S. They're also now higher than what we're seeing in the public markets. So that's obviously a rare occurrence, and maybe it's really to exactly what you're talking about. But should investors be concerned, and is there a broader context here?
Yeah, I mean, investors are always fixated on purchase price multiples. You know, we've done analysis that suggests that purchase price multiples are not the big driver of returns. Obviously, if you pay too much and the company stumbles, you made a mistake, less margin for error. But I think investors' fixation on that is probably misplaced. I'll tell a couple of things. One is, and we refer to this in the market overview, that Teddy Forsman, who was one of the great investors in private equity, had lunch with him, and he said, you know where price is in the top 10 of the most important things in buying an asset? It's like, no, I don't know. Number 11. And I think his point was, if you have a great asset, do you really care if you spend 10 for it or 11? If it's a great asset, it's a great asset. And if you're going to sell it for 30, okay, maybe you could have made an extra unit, but is that really the big deal? The other thing I think that is making purchase price multiples today a little bit off is what we talked about before, the lack of deal activity or the lower deal activity. The deals that are getting done today are amazing companies with no hint of problems. And so people are willing to pay up for them. And I suspect that if you parse the data, you would find that's the big driver. So this could be one of the market overview things for next year. That's what drives a lot of the purchase price multiple numbers. Because companies that have any hiccup that would normally sell at a much lower multiple just aren't selling because the buyer and seller can't agree on a price. So I suspect today I'd be a little wary of saying, oh, prices are too high. The other thing I'd say is historically when private prices have been higher than public has not been a very bad time to buy. So I don't, again, intuitively you go, well, it's got to be bad. Not true.
Well, I like to think that we're helping you create next year's market overview.
That'd be fun.
But
that'd
certainly
be great.
We've delved into the questions around, you know, does leverage impact the performance? So why not purchase price multiple? Okay, Mario, I've heard you say that each year the conclusion section of the market overview is the toughest to write. You're trying to distill thousands of words and dozens of pages into a single page summary. So those who like to just turn to the end of the book, what advice do you dole out in this year's conclusion?
Well, I do want to, I think you're right. The conclusions of anything are really interesting because you ask yourself, who is reading it? Is it the reader who hasn't bothered to read the rest?
Right.
And so you're really doing an executive summary, or is it something else? I think we've always taken the view that it is something else. And so what you see in this year's overview is, because I think it's one of the great underrated things about investors, there is a whole part of being a successful investor in any market that has more to do with yourself and how you are and your ego and your motivations and how you think about the world. And so that a lot of the conclusion is not, oh, by the way, fundraising was up or down. It is you need to look at yourself and think about investing from that perspective. And we use some of Shakespeare, who I think has some pretty interesting ideas about the self and some observations on behavior, and really try to get people to just think about it that way, that so much of this is about individuals and about collective behavior, and investing in many ways does have a psychological component.
Right.
And so let's all be aware of that.
Right. And by no means are we saying that people should cut to the end. They should absolutely see the data, watch the video.
It's okay to cut to the end if you then go back to the beginning.
I'm okay with that.
But it would be unfair to cut to the end because there's a lot.
The thing about
this overview and that we've always done, it's informative. I believe there is more information, and some of this is bragging, I get it, but I'm going to brag for a minute. It's really informative, and there's data you just don't get anywhere else. But informing people is not enough. You have to entertain them. You have to make them smile. You have to make them think and create something that makes them go, oh, never thought of that or never seen that presented that way. So to me, I think what we do an effective job, the entire organization, is having the information, but at least making it interesting. I mean, you've read some of these 20-page reports from other houses, and oh my God, you just want to throw it away with like two paragraphs in.
Well, you say that, we know this takes a considerable amount of time, and now that we've gotten this year's behind us, when do you start next year's? Like
April.
How soon?
It's literally April you start. You kind of start with a couple
of
things.
So within weeks.
Yeah, within weeks. It's not written, obviously,
right.
But what you start doing is what are people interested in?
Mm.
You know, what kind of things are people talking about? And are there interesting data angles? So the way this really works is we will have, I don't know, 15 or 20 different ideas. And then our research team, Brian Jenkins and the group, will come back and go, no, like these five, there's no data on it.
Right.
Or these five, oh yeah, we can do this in a more interesting way. And it sort of builds iteratively, but the process kind of starts in April. The theme, you start thinking about June, July. This year will be tougher because there's a couple of big elections,
right.
The US, the UK. And so we don't know how those will impact markets and what's going on. But yeah, no, it starts pretty soon.
Well, it should be an interesting one. Thank you, Mario.
No, thank you. Thank you. As you can tell, we're all very passionate about this, and everyone has a lot of fun doing it.
It is a lot of fun. And I continue to hear from people about how much they enjoy it and how much they take away from it. So we certainly encourage everyone to listen. Thank you for listening in to another episode of Private Markets Made Human. Please stay tuned for our next episode and visit our website to access the 2024 Market Overview, where we dive even further into the trends shaping the private markets industry today.